The light had flicked on, and Nath froze in place, blinking at the doorway, where a tall, bearded boy and the girl holding his hand slowly emerged from the blinding haze. She had long red hair, loose in waves around her face. "Sorry," Wes had said and flipped the lights off. And Nath heard their careful footsteps as they made their way across the common room to Wes's bedroom. He had kept his eyes open, letting them readjust to the dark, thinking, "So this is what college is like." Now he thinks back to last night, when he had arrived home just before dinner. Lydia had been holed up in her room, and when they sat down at the table, he'd asked her how the past few days had been. She'd shrugged and barely glanced up from her plate, and he had assumed this meant nothing new. Now he can't remember if she'd even said hello. In her room up in the attic, Hannah leans over the edge of her bed and fishes her book from beneath the dust ruffle. It's Lydia's book, actually. The Sound and the Fury. Advanced English. Not meant for fifth graders. She'd filched it from Lydia's room a few weeks ago, and Lydia hadn't even noticed. Over the past 2 weeks, she's worked her way through it, a little each night, savoring the words like a cherry lifesaver tucked inside her cheek. Tonight, somehow, the book seems different. Only when she flips back to where she stopped the day before does she understand. Throughout, Lydia has underlined words here and there, occasionally scribbling a note from class lectures. Order versus chaos. Corruption of Southern aristocratic values. After this page, the book is untouched. Hannah flips through the rest. No notes, no doodles, no blue to break up the black. She's reached the point where Lydia stopped reading, she realizes. And she doesn't feel like reading anymore. Last night, lying awake, she had watched the moon drift across the sky like a slow balloon. She couldn't see it moving, but if she looked away, then back through the window, she could see that it had. In a little while, she had thought, it would impale itself on the shadow of the big spruce in the backyard. It took a long time. She was almost asleep when she heard a soft thud. And for a moment, she thought that the moon had actually hit the tree. But when she looked outside, the moon was gone, almost hidden behind a cloud. Her glow-in-the-dark clock said it was 2 a.m. She lay quiet, not even wiggling her toes, and listened. The noise had sounded like the front door closing. It was sticky. You had to push it with your hip to get it to latch. Burglars, she thought. Through the window, she saw a single figure crossing the front lawn. Not a burglar. Just a thin silhouette against darker night, moving away. Lydia? A vision of life without her sister in it had flashed across her mind. She would have the good chair at the table, looking out the window at the lilac bushes in the yard. The big bedroom downstairs near everyone else. At dinner time, they would pass her the potatoes first. She would get her father's jokes, her brother's secrets, her mother's best smiles. Then the figure reached the street and disappeared, and she wondered if she had seen it at all. Now, in her room, she looks down at the tangle of text. It was Lydia. She's sure of it now. Should she tell? Her mother would be upset that Hannah had let Lydia, her favorite, just walk away. And Nath? She thinks of the way Nath's eyebrows have been drawn together all evening. The way he has bitten his lips so hard, without realizing that it has begun to crack and bleed. He'd be angry, too. He'd say, "Why didn't you run out and catch her?" "But I didn't know where she was going," Hannah whispers into the dark. I didn't know she was really going anywhere. Wednesday morning, James calls the police again. Were there any leads? They were checking all possibilities. Could the officer tell them anything? Anything at all? They still expected Lydia would come home on her own. They were following up and would, of course, keep the family informed. James listens to all this and nods, though he knows Officer Fisk can't see him. He hangs up and sits back down at the table without looking at Marilyn or Nath or Hannah. He doesn't need to explain anything. They can tell by the look on his face that there's no news. It doesn't seem right to do anything but wait. The children stay home from school. Television, magazines, radio. Everything feels frivolous in the face of their fear. Outside, it's sunny, the air crisp and cool. But no one suggests that they move to the porch or the yard. Even housekeeping seems wrong. Some clue might be sucked into the vacuum, some hint obliterated by lifting the dropped book and placing it upright on the shelf. So the family waits. They cluster at the table, afraid to meet each other's eyes, staring at the wood grain of the tabletop as if it's a giant fingerprint, or a map locating what they seek. It's not until Wednesday afternoon that a passerby notices the rowboat out on the lake, adrift in the windless day. Years ago, the lake had been Middlewood's reservoir, before the water tower was built. Now, edged with grass, it's a swimming hole in summer. Kids dive off the wooden dock, and for birthday parties and picnics, a park employee unties the rowboat kept there. No one thinks much of it. A slipped mooring, a harmless prank. It is not a priority. A note is made for an officer to check it. A note is made for the commissioner of parks. It's not until late Wednesday, almost midnight, that a lieutenant, going over loose ends from the day shift, makes the connection and calls the Lees to ask if Lydia ever played with the boat on the lake. "Of course not," James says. Lydia had refused to take swim classes at the Y. He'd been a swimmer as a teenager himself. He'd taught Nath to swim at age 3. With Lydia, he'd started too late, and she was already 5 when he took her to the pool for the first time and waded into the shallow end, water barely to his waist, and waded. Lydia would not even come near the water. She'd laid down in her swimsuit by the side of the pool and cried, and James finally hoisted himself out, swim trunks dripping but top half dry, and promised he would not make her jump. Even now, though the lake is so close, Lydia goes in just ankle deep in summer to wash the dirt from her feet. "Of course not," James says again. "Lydia doesn't know how to swim." It's not until he says these words into the telephone that he understands why the police are asking. As he speaks, the entire family catches a chill, as if they know exactly what the police will find. It's not until early Thursday morning, just after dawn, that the police drag the lake and find her. 2. How had it begun? Like everything, with mothers and fathers. Because of Lydia's mother and father. Because of her mothers and father's mothers and fathers. Because long ago, her mother had gone missing, and her father had brought her home. Because more than anything, her mother had wanted to stand out. Because more than anything, her father had wanted to blend in. Because those things had been impossible. In her first year at Radcliffe, 1955, Marilyn had enrolled in introductory physics, and her advisor glanced at her course schedule and paused. He was a plump man with a tweed suit and a crimson bow tie. A dark gray hat brimmed down on the table beside him. "Why do you want to take physics?" he asked. And she explained shyly that she was hoping to become a doctor. "Not a nurse?" he'd said with a chuckle. From a folder, he'd pulled her high school transcript and studied it. "Well," he said, "I see you received very good grades in your high school physics course." She'd had the highest grade in her class, had set the curve on every test. She had loved physics. But he couldn't know that. On the transcript, it said only A. She held her breath, waiting, afraid he would tell her that science was too hard, that she'd better try something like English or history instead. In her mind, she prepared her retort. Instead, he said, "All right, then. Why don't you try chemistry, if you think you can handle it?" and signed her course slip and handed it over just like that. When she arrived at the laboratory, though, she found herself the only girl in a room of 15 men. The instructor tut-tutted and said, "Miss Walker, you'd better tie up those golden locks." "Can I light the burner for you?" someone else would say. "Let me open that jar for you." When she broke a beaker the second day of class, three men rushed to her side. "Careful," they said. "Better let us help." Everything, she soon realized, started with "better." "Better let me pour that acid for you." "Better stand back. This will make a pop." By the third day of class, she decided to show them. She said, "No, thank you," when people offered to make her pipettes, then hid a grin as they watched her melt glass tubes over the Bunsen burner and stretch them like taffy into perfectly tapered droppers. While her classmates sometimes splashed their lab coats, burning holes all the way down through their suits, she measured acids with steady hands. Her solutions never bubbled onto the counter like baking soda volcanoes. Her results were the most accurate, her lab reports the most complete. By midterm, she set the curve for every exam, and the instructor had stopped smirking. She had always liked surprising people that way. In high school, she had approached her principal with a request to take shop instead of home ec. It was 1952, and in Boston, researchers were just beginning to develop a pill that would change women's lives forever. But girls still wore skirts to school, and in Virginia, her request had been radical. Home economics was required for every sophomore girl, and Marilyn's mother, Doris Walker, was the only home ec teacher at Patrick Henry Senior High. Marilyn had asked to switch into shop with the sophomore boys. It was the same class period, she pointed out. Her schedule wouldn't be disrupted. Mr. Tolliver, the principal, knew her well. She had been at the top of her class, girls and boys, since the sixth grade, and her mother had taught at the school for years. So he nodded and smiled as she made her case. Then he shook his head. "I'm sorry," he said. "We can't make an exception for anyone, or everyone will expect it." At the look on Marilyn's face, he reached across the desk and patted her hand. "Some of the equipment in the shop would be difficult for you to use," he told her. "And to be honest, Miss Walker, having a girl like you in the classroom would be very distracting to the boys in the class." He meant it as a compliment, she knew. But she also knew that it wasn't. She smiled and thanked him for his time. It wasn't a true smile, and her dimples didn't show. So she had slouched in the back row of the home ec classroom, waiting out the first day welcome speech her mother had given for a dozen years, drumming her fingers as her mother promised to teach them everything a young lady needed to keep a house. As if, Marilyn thought, It might run away when you weren't looking. She studied the other girls in her class, noting who bit her nails, whose sweater was pilled, who smelled faintly of a cigarette snuck over lunch. Across the hall, she could see Mr. Landis, the shop teacher, demonstrating the correct way to hold a hammer. Keeping house, she had thought. Each day she watched her classmates, clumsy and thimbled fingers, sucking the ends of thread, squinting for the needle's eye. She thought of her mother's insistence on changing clothes before dinner, though there was no longer a husband to impress with her fresh face and crisp house dress. It was after her father left that her mother had begun to teach. Marilyn had been three. Her clearest memory of her father was a feel and a smell. The bristle of his cheek against hers as he lifted her up, and the tingle of old spice in her nostrils. She didn't remember his leaving, but knew it had happened. Everyone did. And now everyone had more or less forgotten it. Newcomers to the school district assumed Mrs. Walker was a widow. Her mother herself never mentioned it. She still powdered her nose after cooking and before eating. She still put on lipstick before coming downstairs to make breakfast. So they called it keeping house for a reason, Marilyn thought. Sometimes it did run away. In an English class, on a test, she wrote, "Irony, a contradictory outcome of events, as if in mockery of the promise and fitness of things," and received an A. She began tangling the thread on her sewing machine. She snipped patterns without unfolding them, making paper-cut lace of the layers beneath. Her zippers ripped out of their dresses. She stirred eggshell fragments into the pancake batter. She switched salt and sugar in the sponge cake. One day she left her iron face down on the board, causing not only a blackened burn in the cover but enough smoke to set off the fire sprinklers. That evening, at dinner, her mother finished her last bite of potato and set her knife and fork down, crossed neatly on the plate. "I know what you're trying to prove," she said, "but believe me, I will fail you if you keep this up." Then she gathered the dishes and carried them to the sink. Marilyn did not move to help as she usually did. She watched her mother tie a ruffled apron around her waist, fingers knotting the strings in one quick motion. After the last dish was washed, her mother rinsed her hands and applied a dab of lotion from the bottle on the counter. Then she came to the table, brushed Marilyn's hair from her face, and kissed her forehead. Her hands smelled like lemons. Her lips were dry and warm. For the rest of her life, this would be what Marilyn thought of first when she thought of her mother. Her mother, who had never left her hometown 80 miles from Charlottesville, who always wore gloves outside the house, and who never, in all the years Marilyn could remember, sent her to school without a hot breakfast, who never mentioned Marilyn's father after he left, but raised her alone, who, when Marilyn earned a scholarship to Radcliffe, hugged her for a long time and whispered, "How proud I am of you. You have no idea." And then, when she loosened her arms, looked into Marilyn's face and tucked her hair behind her ears and said, "You know, you'll meet a lot of wonderful Harvard men." It would bother Marilyn for the rest of her life that her mother had been right. She worked her way through chemistry, majored in physics, ticked the requirements for medical school off her list. Late at night, bent over her textbooks while her roommate wound curlers into her hair and patted cold cream onto her cheeks and went to bed, Marilyn sipped double-strength tea and kept awake by picturing herself in a white doctor's coat, laying a cool hand against a feverish forehead, touching a stethoscope to a patient's chest. It was the furthest thing she could imagine from her mother's life.